listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
中国人民对自己选择的发展道路，中国特色社会主义
Chinese people are confident in developing socialism with Chinese characteristics.
That was Hua Chunying, spokesperson for China's foreign ministry, delivering Beijing's response to the new national security strategy announced Monday by U.S. President Donald Trump.
Other countries cannot deny the achievement that we have made. Other countries cannot stop Chinese people from building socialism with Chinese characteristics and gaining even greater achievements. China will continue firmly taking the road of peaceful development, promoting win-win cooperation with other countries, and calling for building equal diplomatic relations between countries. China will remain as a contributor to global development and world peace.
China urged the U.S. to stop distorting Beijing's strategic intentions and to abandon Cold War thinking and a zero-sum mindset. They condemned Trump's strategy, which labeled China and Russia as revisionist powers, determined to reshape the world according to their own ends. Russia's government also had criticism and a hopeful note as well. Dmitry Peskov, who is the spokesperson for the Russian president, stressed that although Moscow strongly disagrees with Washington's position, as expressed in the document, there were positive signs as well. Peskov mentioned the recent exchange of information between the two countries' special services, which made it possible to thwart terrorist attacks in St. Petersburg, which Peskov said helped save many lives. Up next, President Trump's speech in its entirety, delivered Monday on U.S. foreign policy and national security strategy.
We're here today to discuss matters of vital importance to us all, America's security, prosperity, and standing in the world. I want to talk about where we've been, where we are now, and finally, our strategy for where we are going in the years ahead. Over the past 11 months, I have traveled tens of thousands of miles to visit 13 countries. I have met with more than 100 world leaders. I have carried America's message to a grand hall in Saudi Arabia, a great square in Warsaw, to the General Assembly of the United Nations, and to the seat of democracy on the Korean Peninsula. Everywhere I traveled, it was my highest privilege and greatest honor to represent the American people. Throughout our history, the American people have always been the true source of American greatness. Our people have promoted our culture and promoted our values. Americans have fought and sacrificed on the battlefields all over the world. We have liberated captive nations, transformed former enemies into the best of friends, and lifted entire regions of the planet from poverty to prosperity. Because of our people, America has been among the greatest forces for peace and justice in the history of the world. The American people are generous. You are determined, you are brave, you are strong, and you are wise. When the American people speak, all of us should listen. And just over 1 year ago, you spoke loud and you spoke clear. On November 8th, 2016, you voted to make America great again. You embraced new leadership and very new strategies, and also a glorious new hope. That is why we are here today. But to seize the opportunities of the future, we must first understand the failures of the past. For many years, our citizens watched as Washington politicians presided over one disappointment after another. To many of our leaders, so many, who forgot whose voices they were to respect and whose interests they were supposed to defend. Our leaders in Washington negotiated disastrous trade deals that brought massive profits to many foreign nations, but sent thousands of American factories and millions of American jobs to those other countries. Our leaders engaged in nation building abroad while they failed to build up and replenish our nation at home. They undercut and shortchanged our men and women in uniform with inadequate resources, unstable funding, and unclear missions. They failed to insist that our often very wealthy allies pay their fair share for defense, putting a massive and unfair burden on the U.S. taxpayer and our great U.S. military. They neglected a nuclear menace in North Korea, made a disastrous, weak, and incomprehensibly bad deal with Iran, and allowed terrorists such as ISIS to gain control of vast parts of territory all across the Middle East. They put American energy under lock and key. They imposed punishing regulations and crippling taxes. They surrendered our sovereignty to foreign bureaucrats in faraway and distant capitals. And over the profound objections of the American people, our politicians left our borders wide open. Millions of immigrants entered illegally. Millions more were admitted into our country without the proper vetting needed to protect our security and our economy. Leaders in Washington imposed on the country an immigration policy that Americans never voted for, never asked for, and never approved. A policy where the wrong people are allowed into our country and the right people are rejected. American citizens, as usual, have been left to bear the cost and to pick up the tab. On top of everything else, our leaders drifted from American principles. They lost sight of America's destiny, and they lost their belief in American greatness. As a result, our citizens lost something as well. The people lost confidence in their government and eventually even lost confidence in their future. But last year, all of that began to change. The American people rejected the failures of the past. You rediscovered your voice and reclaimed ownership of this nation and its destiny. On January 20th, 2017, I stood on the steps of the Capitol to herald the day the people became the rulers of their nation again. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, less than 1 year later, I am proud to report that the entire world has heard the news and has already seen the signs. America is coming back, and America is coming back strong. Upon my inauguration, I announced that the United States would return to a simple principle. The first duty of our government is to serve its citizens, many of whom have been forgotten, but they are not forgotten anymore. With every decision and every action, we are now putting America first. We are rebuilding our nation, our confidence, and our standing in the world. We have moved swiftly to confront our challenges, and we have confronted them head on. We are once again investing in our defense, almost $700 billion, a record this coming year. We are demanding extraordinary strength, which will hopefully lead to long and extraordinary peace. We are giving our courageous military men and women the support they need and so dearly deserve. We have withdrawn the United States from job-killing deals such as the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the very expensive and unfair Paris Climate Accord. And on our trip to Asia last month, I announced that we will no longer tolerate trading abuse. We have established strict new vetting procedures to keep terrorists out of the United States, and our vetting is getting tougher each month. To counter Iran and block its path to a nuclear weapon, I sanctioned the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps for its support of terrorism, and I declined to certify the Iran deal to Congress. Following my trip to the Middle East, the Gulf states and other Muslim-majority nations joined together to fight radical Islamist ideology and terrorist financing. We have dealt ISIS one devastating defeat after another. The coalition to defeat ISIS has now recaptured almost 100% of the land once held by these terrorists in Iraq and in Syria. Great job. Great job. Really good. Really good. Thank you. Thank you. We have a great military. We're now chasing them wherever they flee, and we will not let them into the United States. In Afghanistan, our troops are no longer undermined by artificial timelines, and we no longer tell our enemies of our plans. We are beginning to see results on the battlefield, and we have made clear to Pakistan that while we desire continued partnership, we must see decisive action against terrorist groups operating on their territory. And we make massive payments every year to Pakistan. They have to help. Our efforts to strengthen the NATO alliance set the stage for significant increases in member contributions, with tens of billions of dollars more pouring in, because I would not allow member states to be delinquent in the payment while we guarantee their safety and are willing to fight wars for them. We have made clear that countries that are immensely wealthy should reimburse the United States for the cost of defending them. This is a major departure from the past, but a fair and necessary one. Necessary for our country, necessary for our taxpayer, necessary for our own thought process. Our campaign of maximum pressure on the North Korean regime has resulted in the toughest ever sanctions. We have united our allies in an unprecedented effort to isolate North Korea. However, there is much more work to do. America and its allies will take all necessary steps to achieve a denuclearization and ensure that this regime cannot threaten the world. Thank you. This situation should have been taken care of long before I got into office, when it was much easier to handle. But it will be taken care of. We have no choice. At home, we are keeping our promises and liberating the American economy. We have created more than 2 million jobs since the election. Unemployment is at a 17-year low. The stock market is at an all-time high, and just a little while ago hit yet another all-time high, the 85th time since my election. We have cut 22 regulations for every one new regulation, the most in the history of our country. We have unlocked America's vast energy resources. As the world watches, and the world is indeed watching, we are days away from passing historic tax cuts for American families and businesses. It will be the biggest tax cut and tax reform in the history of our country. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And we are seeing the response we fully expected. Economic growth has topped 3% for two quarters in a row. GDP growth, which is way ahead of schedule under my administration, will be one of America's truly greatest weapons. Optimism has surged. Confidence has returned. With this new confidence, we are also bringing back clarity to our thinking. We are reasserting these fundamental truths. A nation without borders is not a nation. A nation that does not protect prosperity at home cannot protect its interests abroad. A nation that is not prepared to win a war is a nation not capable of preventing a war. A nation that is not proud of its history cannot be confident in its future. And a nation that is not certain of its values cannot summon the will to defend them. Today, grounded in these truths, we are presenting to the world our new national security strategy. Based on my direction, this document has been in development for over a year. It has the endorsement of my entire cabinet. Our new strategy is based on a principled realism, guided by our vital national interests and rooted in our timeless values. This strategy recognizes that whether we like it or not, we are engaged in a new era of competition. We accept that vigorous military, economic, and political contests are now playing out all around the world. We face rogue regimes that threaten the United States and our allies. We face terrorist organizations, transnational criminal networks, and others who spread violence and evil around the globe. We also face rival powers, Russia and China, that seek to challenge American influence, values, and wealth. We will attempt to build a great partnership with those and other countries, but in a manner that always protects our national interest. As an example, yesterday I received a call from President Putin of Russia thanking our country for the intelligence that our CIA was able to provide them concerning a major terrorist attack planned in St. Petersburg, where many people, perhaps in the thousands, could have been killed. They were able to apprehend these terrorists before the event with no loss of life, and that's a great thing. And the way it's supposed to work, that is the way it's supposed to work. But while we seek such opportunities of cooperation, we will stand up for ourselves and we will stand up for our country like we have never stood up before. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. We know that American success is not a foregone conclusion. It must be earned and it must be won. Our rivals are tough, they're tenacious and committed to the long term, but so are we. To succeed, we must integrate every dimension of our national strength, and we must compete with every instrument of our national power. Under the Trump administration, America is gaining wealth, leading to enhanced power faster than anyone thought, with $6 trillion more in the stock market alone since the election. $6 trillion. With the strategy I am announcing today, we are declaring that America is in the game and America is going to win. Our strategy, thank you. Our strategy advances four vital national interests. First, we must protect the American people, the homeland, and our great American way of life. This strategy recognizes that we cannot secure a nation if we do not secure our borders. So for the first time ever, American strategy now includes a serious plan to defend our homeland. It calls for the construction of a wall on our southern border, ending chain migration and the horrible visa and lottery programs, closing loopholes that undermine enforcement, and strongly supporting our Border Patrol agents, ICE officers, and Homeland Security personnel. In addition, our strategy calls for us to confront, discredit, and defeat radical Islamic terrorism and ideology, and to prevent it from spreading into the United States. And we will develop new ways to counter those who use new domains such as cyber and social media to attack our nation or threaten our society. The second pillar of our strategy is to promote American prosperity. For the first time, American strategy recognizes that economic security is national security. Economic vitality, growth, and prosperity at home is absolutely necessary for American power and influence abroad. Any nation that trades away its prosperity for security will end up losing both. That is why this national security strategy emphasizes more than ever before the critical steps we must take to ensure the prosperity of our nation for a long, long time to come. It calls for cutting taxes and rolling back unnecessary regulations. It calls for trade based on the principles of fairness and reciprocity. It calls for firm action against unfair trade practices and intellectual property theft, and it calls for new steps to protect our national security, industrial, and innovation base. The strategy proposes a complete rebuilding of American infrastructure, our roads, bridges, airports, waterways, and communications infrastructure. And it embraces a future of American energy dominance and self-sufficiency. The third pillar of our strategy is to preserve peace through strength. We recognize that weakness is the surest path to conflict, and unrivaled power is the most certain means of defense. For this reason, our strategy breaks from the damaging defense sequester. We're going to get rid of that. It calls for a total modernization of our military and reversing previous decisions to shrink our armed forces, even as threats to national security grew. It calls for streamlining acquisition, eliminating bloated bureaucracy, and massively building up our military, which has the fundamental side benefit of creating millions and millions of jobs. This strategy includes plans to counter modern threats, such as cyber and electromagnetic attacks. It recognizes space as a competitive domain and calls for multi-layered missile defense. This strategy outlines important steps to address new forms of conflict, such as economic and political aggression. And our strategy emphasizes strengthening alliances to cope with these threats. It recognizes that our strength is magnified by allies who share principles and our principles and shoulder their fair share of responsibility for our common security. Fourth and finally, our strategy is to advance American influence in the world. But this begins with building up our wealth and power at home. America will lead again. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but we will champion the values without apology. We want strong alliances and partnerships based on cooperation and reciprocity. We will make new partnerships with those who share our goals and make common interests into a common cause. We will not allow inflexible ideology to become an obsolete and obstacle to peace. We will pursue the vision we have carried around the world over this past year, a vision of strong, sovereign, and independent nations that respect their citizens and respect their neighbors. Nations that thrive in commerce and cooperation, rooted in their histories and branching out toward their destinies. That is the future we wish for this world, and that is the future we seek in America. Thank you. With this strategy, we are calling for a great reawakening of America, a resurgence of confidence, and a rebirth of patriotism, prosperity, and pride. And we are returning to the wisdom of our founders. In America, the people govern, the people rule, and the people are sovereign. What we have built here in America is precious and unique. In all of history, never before has freedom reigned, the rule of law prevailed, and the people thrived as we have here for nearly 250 years. We must love and defend it. We must guard it with vigilance and spirit, and if necessary, like so many before us, with our very lives. And we declare that our will is renewed, our future is regained and our dreams are restored. Every American has a role to play in this grand national effort. And today I invite every citizen to take their part in our vital mission. Together, our task is to strengthen our families, to build up our communities, to serve our citizens, and to celebrate American greatness as a shining example to the world. As long as we are proud, and very proud of who we are, how we got here, and what we are fighting for to preserve, we will not fail. If we do all of this, if we rediscover our resolve and commit ourselves to compete and win again, then together we will leave our children and our grandchildren a nation that is stronger, better, freer, prouder, and yes, an America that is greater than ever before. God bless you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The single most important social equalizer of our time, the internet, is under grave threat. The decision by the Federal Communications Commission essentially gives internet service providers the keys to the internet. Without net neutrality, will the economic opportunity divide only widen for all? Crosstalking net neutrality, I'm joined by my guest, Julio Rivera in New York. He is the editorial director for Reactionary Times and a Newsmax columnist. And in Tampa, we have Scott Rickard. He is a former American intelligence linguist. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Scott, let me go to you first in Tampa. First, I want to kind of express my bewilderment, but maybe it shouldn't be bewilderment, and looking at mainstream media covering this story on net neutrality. A lot of stories out there, but the meaning of it seems rather mooted to me. I think it's because so many of these news outlets are owned by internet service providers, okay, like Comcast and others like that here. I mean, what is the significance of this move? Because I think, you know, an era of the internet, and as I said in my introduction, I mean, one of the great social equalizers of our time is under threat. And maybe we'll tell our grandchildren, I remember the golden years. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it's very multifaceted. Obviously, the media companies have a very symbiotic relationship with the carriers. This relationship goes a long way. They pay a lot of money even for local news. You know, it's up to like $7 charge just for local news rebroadcast across cable companies. So you have a real close symbiotic relationship with individuals who are profiting from a current business. So a lot of this really has more to do with the legality of rebroadcast, the copyright component, and obviously the economics. They're trying to transfer the upgrade of their networks to the economic wages of the people. That's what's really happened here. And when you talk about a fast lane versus a slow lane, let's be clear here that the RFCs are written very clearly. Once you're up on the network, the quality of service is actually built in. The bandwidth is there. You know, each strand of fiber will give you 10 gigabit. They've pulled lots of multi-mode, but mostly single-mode fiber around the country. This goes right past everyone's homes, and they can install the equipment on the corners that will absolutely handle the quality of service. What's interesting is that the companies that when you're trying to get faster speeds today are actually making you pay for that equipment by charging exorbitant installation fees. So that's really what's happened. The technology is very simple to give people the quality of service, but what they're up against is they're trying to obviously make more money from something that doesn't really need to happen, very much like Enron, very much like ethanol, and very much like, unfortunately, the carbon tax, charging for air in the United States.
Okay.
And this is how the Americans have done this.
Okay, we have Julio, we have Julio dissenting, and that's what we wanted on this program. Julio, let me go to you in New York. You heard
yeah.
the whole... Let me... Before we explode here, guys, hang on. You know, Julio, I perfectly understand that ISPs, this is a business, and it's serious business, and it's an important business for our time. My most important concern is to make sure that everyone gets to stay in on this platform here. And this is what a lot of people are worried about when it comes to net neutrality. Are we going to have people left behind? Because there are lots of communities in the United States that don't have the best quality internet. And if they're facing higher prices for not an improvement in quality, that leaves them out. That's my primary concern. I have other concerns as well. After this long introduction on my part, my friend, go ahead, Julio, in New York.
Well, you know what? That sounds very conspiratorial there, what Scott was talking about. Listen, the fact of the matter is the people that are getting hurt are people that are due to net neutrality or people in rural areas, people that are in urban areas that are underdeveloped. I mean, the fact of the matter is we're already paying extra for better levels of service. That's already been happening because if you get business class high-speed internet, you pay a little extra and you get a little bit better quality service. It's not like everybody's getting the same level of service across the board. It hasn't been like that. And think about the 20-plus years before 2015 when they put in this additional regulation. The internet thrived. It's not like taking it away is going to make the thing explode. I mean, this is really alarmist nonsense. They're just another reason to attack Donald Trump, saying that he's doing something dangerous. It's really, there's not going to be any consequence. The average person is not going to feel any difference because of this.
Okay, well, Scott, I don't see the Trump connection here so clearly here. There's a lot of people in red and blue states that are concerned about this here. You know, Scott, the argument, you know, that net neutrality slows down investment. I mean, if you look at the bottom lines of the major ISPs, I mean, look at their stock prices. They're doing pretty well here. And so since 2015, investment into infrastructure of these grids, you know, has dipped only a little bit here.
Is down 5%.
What I would say is that
down,
you know, over the last 2 years,
since
the ruling in 2015, things haven't been that bad. And then you have Google and Facebook and so on and so forth saying that they are worried that the ISPs will not be held account, you know, Title II that everyone talks about. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I don't deny the fact that there's any issues with rural areas not getting speed. But let's be clear here that the American government has invested millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in commercial companies. The acquisitions have been tremendous. You look at small companies like CenturyTel that gobbled up Quest, that gobbled up a lot of the CLECs around the Southeast. CenturyTel is now one of the largest companies in the country from a telecom perspective. Obviously, John Malone and Paul Allen have done quite well gobbling up some cable companies recently. So you have a very serious amount of investment that is not only coming from the U.S. government, but also coming from private investors. And this net neutrality thing is absolutely more about the legality of things. Let's be clear here. You know, they're not able to throttle back the Pirate Bays or the Codies or these types of things that are basically bashing into their income. So they're going after the law in a way to actually throttle these things back and block them. Now, let's be clear as well. I cannot find RT on a cable network across the United States. RT is not syndicated on the cable networks in the United States. Let's be clear here as well. I could easily get RT. I know the guys. I ski with these people out in Denver helping out the U.S. disabled ski team. So these are individuals that are absolutely blocking, you know, this type of access for RT. And this will be another thing. This is a freedom of speech issue for me, because in the future, if they don't want us to get RT on the internet, they can actually throttle that back as well. And that's the only place I can get that. So that's my biggest fear.
Okay, well, that's a fear of mine, and I was actually going to get there. We can go there right now. Julio, you know, one of the I said my major concern was equal access. A subsidiary concern is, you know, are we going to see what Comcast and AT&T and Verizon, what they want us to see? Are they going to give them preference? Okay, because I'm sorry, because if Comcast likes wants to support MSNBC, I think the whole world is in trouble here. The question is, will they stay focused on business, or will they be political? Okay, go ahead, Julio.
Well, listen, there's been a couple of isolated incidents. There was the Vonage AT&T thing. There was the Google Wallet thing.
Yep.
But to have this
Netflix
preemptive, sweeping, you know, regulations over everyone in advance. Listen, we have antitrust laws. You know, we have the FTC, which was originally in charge of the internet before it fell under the FTC, under Title II. You know, we don't need another additional layer of regulation. Listen, there were 22 ISPs that went to go to the FCC, and they met with Ajit Pai, that they have, you know, smaller customer bases, less than 1,000 people. They can't grow because banks won't loan them money because of the uncertainty that comes along with this. So, I mean, it's hurting America. It's hurting jobs. It's hurting the level of service. It really didn't do anything positive. And listen, before we had it, we didn't have these widespread issues of, you know, ISPs undermining, you know, their competitors.
Okay, well, Scott, you know, one of the major concerns is that you're going to have the major ISP, they're going to force you to buy their products here, and they will throttle and disappear the competition. See, this is, you know, the internet really thrives when there is competition.
Nobody's
here.
Really technically forced to buy anything.
No, but if you can't see that you can't see something, you can't buy it. Okay, that is the whole problem here. Is the, again, every step of the way, it's equal access. If it's political ideas or products or being able to be on the internet in the first place. Go ahead, Scott. 1 minute before we go to the break.
Well, when you look at the failure of the competitive local exchange carriers, and they did try this, they deregulated in 1996. The Americans gave away the keys to the kingdom. A lot of foreign countries came in and bought American infrastructure. You have foreign intelligence that has manufactured and installed intelligence collection devices on American networks, getting data prior to NSA getting it, actually. So there's a real serious problem from the deregulation from 96. But at the same time, when you look at current competition, you know, let's be clear, AOL built their networks upon advanced network systems. Advanced network systems were the guys that built ARPANET for the folks at Bolt, Baranek, and Newman and managed it for the guys. So this is not a competition environment. Obviously, Time Warner has some of the best actual landlines and best actual fiber across the country after buying the ARPANET infrastructure. Certainly, these guys at Sprint have some great infrastructure because they're railroad connections. So this is not a competitive environment. These are individuals who understand at a much higher level. I've attended meetings at the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Council, and so I understand these types of issues. And the most Americans, they don't understand this. So when you talk about competition, no, there is no competition. There is absolute control. And the worst thing that I find is that these types of individuals that are controlling it can control our access to information.
I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. You'll have your chance after the short break. After our short break, we'll continue our discussion on the future of the internet. Stay on RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Julio, let's go back to you in New York. Scott had the last word in the first part of the program, and you were dissenting. Please go.
Well, I was just going to say, we can't foster an environment that creates monopolies. I mean, these smaller guys still at least have to have a fighting chance. Listen, there's over 4,000 individual ISPs in this country. You know, obviously we have the big dogs, you know, and they're the ones that control the majority of it. But how are consumers ever going to have a choice, you know, if these smaller people can't even compete in the market. And I, on a side note, I just wanted to bring up, you know, going back to something that Scott said earlier, isn't it ironic, or isn't it really not really that surprising that we would give up, you know, or give foreign access to our internet infrastructure in the 90s under the Clintons? Isn't that like follow a pattern that we wound up seeing she was Secretary of State?
That's a totally different topic, and I like it. I like it. That's a good one there, okay? All right. You know, Scott, you know.
But doesn't it?
Yeah. There's always patterns with that cabal of people. You know, Scott, you know. Okay, we just heard from Julio. There's a lot of very small ISPs. But you know what? It's really almost a monopoly-like environment. It's the same thing with Facebook. It's the same thing with Google here. This is another thing I'm concerned is more and more concentration. And now it looks like the FCC reports to the ISPs. That's what it looks like after this ruling here. It is shedding responsibility. I mean, the FCC is supposed to make sure that people have access to broadband, okay? I mean, on the very top of their responsibilities. I wonder, looking at, you know, shouldn't these big companies be broken up? And we had Standard Oil. We had other major companies that were broken up. I mean, it seems to me there's too much concentration of power, too much concentration of money, and it's bad for the marketplace and for consumers. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, they've tried that. They did break up Ma Bell. Bell was broken up, and then they actually were divorced and they remarried under AT&T, yep. And all the Bells came back together. They also tried that with the Celex, a lot of people did make some decent money, but obviously those have been all basically gobbled back up. They did the same thing in the cable industry. Those all started out very local, and you had Advance Newhouse, one of the ones early on. Here in the Florida area, but they've also, the Time Warners and the individuals that own the backbone infrastructure, you know, it's very similar, like you brought up with Standard Oil. They own the railway system that was transporting the oil, and that's how they controlled the industry. Well, the same thing goes for the backbone infrastructure for the internet. That is owned by a very small select group of people who are controlling that transport on those backbone infrastructures. And, you know, that infrastructure is very easily managed. You look at the kinds of interconnects that they have. You know, each single mode fiber will do 10 gigabit of bandwidth. And they have tons of single mode fiber pulled where they need it, and they can always pull more. So there's not a problem with the bandwidth issue. I think what it comes down to is, like you said, with rural areas and individuals, I live in a neighborhood, for example, that hasn't been upgraded for the telecom industry. So I can only get 7 megabit to my house. But on the cable side, I can get 100 megabit to my house, mm-hmm. which is plenty for these days. I mean, there's plenty of transport to my home at this point. At 7 megabit, I would be challenged. I mean, obviously, I can't stream as well across that. Is the quality of service as good on the streaming that I can get from my cable provider? Absolutely not. When I go out to Cody and other places, obviously the origination point and the termination point will determine where the bandwidth and quality is going to be. So I can't get as good a quality, but the way that they buffer and they do their compression, I get a pretty decent quality bringing stuff in, even from across the planet. So it's pretty darn good. Obviously, when you're getting out to rural areas, it takes more investment. Are the companies investing in rural areas? Absolutely not. They're investing in 5G. They're going to make everything wireless. They're actually going to put the wires out of business in the neighborhoods by basically installing stuff on towers and poles. It's moving in a different direction.
Yeah, but Julio, so. I mean, are we going to get kind of an internet apartheid in the U.S.? Is this what it's leading to?
No, I don't think. No, I don't necessarily think it's going to. Listen, I think that now it's going to be a little bit more competitive. I think that, you know, these smaller companies, or even if they wanted to combine and band together, perhaps, and, you know, and fight the big machine, let's say, you know, like I said, it's better to not have an environment where the monopoly just gets more powerful. That's basically what net neutrality did. I mean, you look at it, it's in the billions of dollars of lost investment. You know, and all the studies that came out, and granted, people, you know, complained about the studies because they were funded by, you know, the ISPs, but
that's
interesting. Very telling.
Let's talk about let's see what money can do here. Scott, you know, I mean, I looked at some sources, you know, $101 million came from these ISPs lobbying Congress. I suppose they lended their pen and paper and said,
Don't you worry. We'll take care of that bill for you, okay? I mean, I looked at the list of everyone taking money. That's remarkably bipartisan. Probably the only bipartisan thing I've seen lately. People taking money from the ISPs. Let me go to Scott. Let me go to Scott, and then we'll go to Julio. Go ahead. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, absolutely. I mean, obviously, who you know and who you pay off. You know, we do live in a country of the history of the Meyer Lanskys, the history of the Lucky Lucianos. Just like Truman was bought and sold by the mob, we have our current real estate mobster in chief who has also been in bed with the mob for several decades now. So, you know, this is a problem in the United States. You know, buying and selling politicians is not a new game. They've been bought and sold on both sides of the aisle for quite some time by different interest groups. And obviously, net neutrality did not hurt anything from a business perspective. It's creating another false business model, just like Enron. And this is what we're up against. You know, we're up against individuals who are, you know, building an industry based upon not creating anything, but going towards a service model that absolutely charges for something that is unnecessary to charge for.
Julio, you are dissenting again on the program. Go ahead.
No, but I was going to say, listen, when Ajit Pai, before he became, you know, involved with the FCC, he was basically working with a group that was very anti-net neutrality back in 2015, and it was a group made up of the smaller ISPs. You're not really getting the anti-net neutrality stuff so much from the big dogs, you know, because they're the ones that are propped up by this type of, you know, overlapping, unnecessary legislation or regulation, rather, that only really hurts their competitors. You know, so if they have to go through a couple of extra hoops, they don't mind doing it because they can afford to do it as so long as it crushes their competition. They never have to worry about not being on top. And that's the issue here.
OK, well, Scott, I mean, we're kind of looking at it from different points of view here, because I see, you know, it's not all that competitive here. I mean, what's competitive is their services, and, you know, and they have different services and content here. But I mean, we're looking at, you know, I know there are a lot of ISPs, but there, you know, there's a few elephants in the room, and everything else is very, very marginalized. And it seems to me the FCC is just again walking back. It's going in the wrong direction, because I don't see that these smaller guys are going to be protected.
I mean, keep that's growing, though.
Okay. Well, that's good. But if they go, going back to the beginning of the program, if everybody has access, okay, and I don't see that's happening again. I see a step back where people are going to get really crappy service and going to have to pay a lot of money for it. That's not good. Again, everyone should have access
that's
to broadband.
Kind of
everybody should have access to water and air, too. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, it's broadband.
Well, I mean, when
it
comes to the smaller ISPs, obviously,
it's really not.
A lot of the smaller ISPs were against net neutrality because it took a lot for them to deploy their infrastructure. You know, they couldn't keep up, and they had to rent space in order to provide the quality of service that people were demanding. And they have to rent space from the big guys, and it's not cheap. I mean, they're renting quality in their co-location centers, and they'd like to have their own co-location centers and have their own infrastructure. And when the smaller guys do get together, and I don't blame them, they don't want to have the same demands put on them by net neutrality, which I understand that. They can't afford it. And at the same time, they're not going to win this game. They're just going to be gobbled up as soon as they get enough customers anyway. So the fact is that this is the status quo in American capitalism that you see, and this is how it's always been. And I don't think it's going to change much with the FCC ruling. I think the most interesting thing here that everybody's missing is that this is a legality issue. This is how the ISPs will legally block content that they don't want on their networks. Yeah. They will legally block and throttle back things that they don't want to prioritize on their network.
Julio, a lot of the supporters of net neutrality say they're going to go to court. What are their chances of winning?
All right, well, listen, I wanted to bring that up from the legality issue. You know, forget net neutrality. There was a decision recently between two software companies, Enigma Software and Malwarebytes. It's one of my columns up on Newsmax, where an interpretation of the Communications Decency Act actually allowed one company legally to engage in a torturous interference against a competitor. Malwarebytes went after Enigma unfairly, and basically they were protected by the Communications Decency Act. So whether or not we have net neutrality protecting us or not, these ISPs can go ahead and do that and then just have coverage under that law until it's a piece of legislation that was poorly written. There's actually a mistake in the way it was written, which I pointed out in my column, but they would have protection under the Communications Decency Act, even if net neutrality is not there.
Okay, well, do you think this will be overturned through the courts? Okay, I want to ask maybe Scott real quickly, and then maybe Scott can finish up. What about the court option? Julio.
The court option? Listen, yeah. I don't want net neutrality, so I'm fine with it like this.
Okay, Scott.
We can go back to the way it was.
Last few seconds. Go ahead, Scott.
Okay, so you've had several judges speak out against it already and in support of net neutrality. Also, you've had governors actually support of net neutrality. Certainly, a good lawyer knows the law, but a great lawyer knows the judge. So the relationships will trump anything that is for the people, unfortunately.
That's good.
And that will be the case in this scenario, as we see.
That's the best ending on this program in a very long time. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in New York and in Tampa. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.